Podcast New York.
What's up, Dueling Decades? This is Wax. Peace to all you guys, and thanks for having me on the show. Will it be the 90s or the 80s? Beanie Babies or Crack Babies? Will it be Nirvana or Madonna? Maybe Britney, maybe Whitney. Do you like new metal or new wave? Dave Grohl or Super Dave? I don't know, but now the battle begins. Dueling Decades. Let's see who wins.
Dueling Decades.
Broadcasting from the Podcast New York studios, it's the adult-only retro game show where the decades battle for supremacy because it's your history. We just fight for it. Welcome back to Dueling Decades. I am Mark James, and this week we return to the week experience as I will be representing the final week of January 1976 alongside the other duelers and the decades they will be fighting for. First off, popping and locking with the 80s, say hello to Man Crush.
Were they popping and locking in the 80s or the 90s?
In the 80s.
Definitely the 80s.
80s.
Were they? Oh, were they? I always thought that was like a Billy Blanks thing. I don't know.
Tybo and Pop and Lock.
Dude, he's coming back. You see the commercials he's got now? He's got like a Geico commercial or some shit. He's coming back, dude, in a big way. But I have the final week of January 1985, which actually flows into the first day of February. So I have January 26th through February 1st, 1985.
Also joining us on the panel and giving mad props to the 90s, please welcome back to the show, Joe Finley.
Guys, what a pleasure this must be for you. I'm here with the final week of 1992, and really it's almost exclusively 2 days. Well, you'll see when we get into it, but it's a lot of fun. So stay tuned.
And as always here on the show, we need somebody to adjudicate all of this awesomeness. This week's guest judge is back once again behind the bench, and you can listen to his new album, Old Songs from YouTube That Weren't on Streaming Services Until Now, on Spotify. All rise and welcome back to the show, the Honorable Judge Wax.
Yay! So good to be here. What an intro. I love that. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be back.
And your theme song is has been on countless episodes for the past year. So now the people that are brand new to the show, this is the guy that put together the Crack Baby song.
I'm really excited to be here, and you know, like I told you guys before we started filming, if it looks awkward that I'm in a weird position, I'm dealing with a little bit of an upper back injury, so it might be a little visually strange that I'm looking like this. But hey, you know, I'm here to judge, and I'm here to make somebody win.
Hey, you're not even the first horizontal judge we've had on the show, so it's all good.
That's right.
That's true.
That's right. Tawny Katain.
Tawny Katain and me are in the same category.
Yeah, you were both laying down.
Holy moly.
Little funny story about her, though.
Here I go again.
She was
not on my own, though.
She told me the day before she was going in for a surgery, and she said, please give me a call a half hour before we get on the show, just to wake me up, make sure I'm up. So I try to call her, no answer. Like an hour later, she calls and she's like, who is this? And I tell her, and she goes, oh my God, I forgot. Okay, give me 5 minutes. And she shows up, and we're the first people she saw in, like, what was it, like 24 hours? She was completely out.
Wow.
We're the first people she spoke to post-surgery.
It's a good one. So if you have not listened to that episode, go back. I think it was from August, the end of August, maybe somewhere around there. It's quality.
Damn, I'm gonna listen to that. Was she a little, you know, I mean, she had just had surgery, so I guess she was maybe a little out of it.
A little bit. It took her a round or two to get into it.
Yeah, she was tawny, you know?
Tawny sounds like an adjective that means out of it. Yeah, I was a little tawny that day.
Hey, if the shoe fits.
She did try to sell us some vagina-smelling candles, though, so.
Yeah.
What?
That was kind of cool. Yeah. She didn't have any. I think... who was the celebrity that was doing the vagina smelling something?
It was for Goop. It was Gwyneth Paltrow.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So she said hers would smell better. So I still haven't gotten that candle. So yeah.
Jokes on all of them. I make my own.
Ladies and gentlemen, the following contest will be held under Dueling Decades rules. The judges' coin flip shall decide who picks first out of the five Dueling Decades categories: movies, television, music, news, and hot products. A judge's ruling will determine who wins each round, allowing the victor to choose the next available category. The first three rounds are worth 1 point each, with rounds 4 and 5 worth 2 points apiece. And in the event of a tie, after all five rounds, we will go to a final wild card round. Remember, duelers, to review the show, listen, subscribe, and play along at home. It's time for more Dueling Decades. All right, let's head right down to our Judge Wax for the official coin toss.
How do I do a coin toss if there's three options?
Well, it's just going to be let's go Joe versus Mark this time. Mark never gets any love.
I'm flipping it, and I have no idea what side it is, and I'm going to hold up to the camera the what the answer is. Is that cool with y'all?
Joe Finley, why don't you call it in the air?
Okay, let's go tails.
All right, there goes my chance of being a referee. There you go. Bam, what's that say? That's tails. It is tails.
Joe. All right, Joe, you won the coin toss, and you get to select our first category.
All right, well, let's start with music. And I'm going to take you guys to Sydney, Australia on January 25th of 1992, the inaugural Big Day Out Festival. Lots of Australian acts, a lot of alternative acts and that, people like Mass Appeal and Rat Cat and the Meanies, the Hard-Ons featuring Henry Rollins that day. But it was headlined by the Violent Femmes and Nirvana with Nevermind only recently coming out at this point. The festival expanded to 4 cities in 1993, 6 cities in 1994, and ran until 2013, featuring such bands over the time as Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Kanye West, Smashing Pumpkins, The White Stripes, Chemical Brothers, Soundgarden, The Strokes, Rammstein, Marilyn Manson. There's so many here. I could keep listening, and that could be the end of the show. I won't continue to do that, but this was the beginning. This was the very first day of this festival, quite a popular one down under, January 25th, 1992.
All right, Man Crush, what did you bring for the music round?
All right, so let's go to January 28th, 1985. And the great thing here, the 80s and parody, it never stops. And it's going to come up again on this episode, but here's the beginning. So on December 3rd, 1984, you had Bob Geldof and Midge Ure. They put together the super group in the UK named Band Aid. You guys remember this? And they released the timeless Christmas classic, Do They Know It's Christmas, which raised all kinds of money to help put a dent in Africa's huge famine crisis at the time. The single was an instant success, and it propelled the famine, the whole issue, to the world stage. So a month after that release, Harry Belafonte decided that one Band-Aid just wasn't enough, and he recruited music manager Ken Cragen to help him with his own humanitarian vision. And Cragen immediately reached out to one of his clients, Kenny Rogers, and Lionel Richie, and they joined as a team. And then Stevie Wonder got involved, and then they snagged Quincy Jones to co-produce. And then Quincy got Michael Jackson to help out, and the rest is history here. They have all these juggernauts on board right now. So you got Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie. They banged out the lyrics to this track. Over the course of the next couple days after that, they laid down the music, they developed the song. Then on January 28th, 1985, at the A&M Recording Studios in Hollywood, in roughly 9 hours, the track We Are the World was recorded. And coincidentally, I was initially going to pick the American Music Awards for my TV selection, which also took place the same night on the 28th. Many of the performers that recorded the track, they came directly from the award ceremony, which was at ABC Studios in Hollywood, which is why they didn't begin recording until 10 p.m. and it went to like 7 o'clock in the morning. So really, when you think about it, logistically, this was probably the best thing possible to get all these acts in the same room at the same time. So that's another big part of my week here is the American Music Awards, which is basically like the unsung hero of We Are the World right here. But the single was released March 7th, 1985. The single went on to become the first single to ever be certified several times platinum, and also is the biggest single of 1985. The record itself, which I remember my sister owned that, it was literally number one on every chart around the world. literally every single chart, even like the country music, rock charts, everything. By the end of 1986, the proceeds from the USA for Africa is what they called it, and their humanitarian mission, they had raised over $50 million, which was actually their goal. I think they ended up with like 51 and a half or something by the end of 1986. So pretty wild stuff when everybody gets together and does something. Look what can happen. And we get We Are the World, recorded January 28th, 1985.
Fantastic. I actually have a couple copies of that 45 single here in the studio. I found it a few years back. Now, the whole time you're reading that story, Man Crush, the only thing that I could think of is you said they all came from the awards ceremony to the recording studio.
Right.
So you have a bunch of music industry stars going from an award ceremony straight to the recording studio late at night. Could We Are the World be the world's best drunk sing-along?
Oh, it could have been. There's not many stories that came out of it. There was a sign, supposedly, when you walked in that said, leave your egos at the door.
Yeah, I bet everyone was absolutely plastered, man.
Oh, I'm sure that's probably why they probably didn't have like any big problems. But I mean, the names that were there. I mean, Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, Kenny Rogers,
all
Tina Turner, Billy Joel. Yeah. I mean, all these guys, you go down this list, Dan Aykroyd.
Thank God.
Come on.
Drunk and coked up.
10 to 7. There's probably wasn't coke involved.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If you researched who were the ones singing at 5 and 6, that, you know.
Well, I mean, Michael Jackson, he actually recorded his part 2 hours before they even started.
Oh, really?
They said he recorded his solo at 8 o'clock. So nobody was even there when he recorded. So he just skipped the AMA. He was like, fuck that. I'm just going to do my shit.
Good for him.
All right, guys. So for my music selection, much like the subject matter of this song, its journey on the Hot 100 Top 40 was up and down. And on the week ending of January 31st, 1976, it finally hit the very top, grabbing the number one spot before its fast descent back down. But not before becoming a gold record. My music selection is Love Roller Coaster by the Ohio Players. The hit was the second single off the 1975 album Honey, and has since become probably the signature song by the Ohio Players. And it was even covered in 1996 by the Red Hot Chili Peppers for the Beavis and Butthead Do America soundtrack. Unfortunately, that version failed to reach the top spot and stalled at number 22 on the top 40 charts. Love Roller Coaster has also been subject to rumors and, oddly enough, urban legend, as you can hear a high-pitched scream in the background of the song during like one of the instrumental breakdowns. Now, the source of the scream varies on who you've heard the story from and has theories ranging from a girl being murdered, a bunny that was slaughtered outside of the studio at the time of recording, all the way to a scream from being burned from superheated honey by 1974 Playboy playmate Esther Cordette, who actually appeared nude on the album cover for Ohio Players' album Honey. So all of those rumors are where that scream came from. Where did it all start, of course? Well, a DJ made a joke about it on the air once, and people just kept going up to the band members asking him, did you guys kill a girl in the studio? The band took a vow of silence because, well, you sell more records that way. So for the music round, that's what I give you. Love Roller Coaster by the Ohio Players.
So you still don't know?
It was just like one of the guys in the band screaming, of course.
Was it?
Roller Coaster! Of love.
Say what? Your love is like a roller coaster.
I'm just picturing the Beavis and Butthead.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
All right, let's shoot it down to Wax for the judgment on the music round.
Well, this is a really tough one for me because I actually really enjoyed all those picks. I love the Violent Femmes. So that first the Australian festival, I was initially gonna give it to then because I love the Violent Femmes so much. And at first, I was going to give a little bit of a diss. When he first started talking about We Are the World, he was talking about another project. And at first was going to be like, oh, he's just trying to get the schmooze points for the whole humanitarian thing. I see how it is. It's kind of like when somebody goes on Showtime at the Apollo and sings a song about Jesus so they don't get booed off the stage. You know what I mean? So at first I was going to give negative points to We Are the World. But then when you really think about the impact of We Are the World, it really is monumental. But then when you came in with the Ohio Players. They're one of my favorite bands of all time, and I was listening to them today. I was cooking and listening to the Ohio. I wasn't listening to the Honey album. I was listening to the Skin Tight album.
Yep.
But they're one of my favorite bands of all time. Now, does that mean that the success of Love Roller Coaster is anywhere near the $50 million raised by We Are the World? Probably not. But either one of those things have got to kind of beat the Violent Femmes. The Australian Violent Femmes and Nirvana Festival is out. I mean, I apologize for that. But out of those two things, do I go with my love for the Ohio Players or do I go with the... I'm going to go with the Ohio Players. I'm going to go with... We Are the World.
Whoa. Go with the heart.
It's too easy. I mean, it is monumental, but I didn't listen to that today while I was cooking.
Now, the only reason I threw out the Bob Geldof thing is because, and it'll pop up again, there's just a lot of parody in the 80s. Like, something successful comes out, and they copy it. And that's exactly what happened a month afterwards. And actually, Bob Geldof is part of the crew that did the second part, too. So,
is Bob Geldof the guy from Bruce Springsteen's band?
No, Bob Geldof was...
Who's the guy that did
Boomtown Rats.
We Ain't Gonna Play Sun City. What's his name? Ronnie Van Zant. That's what his name. Never mind.
Ron Van Zant. Yep.
All right. Yeah. Well, it's We Are the World. It's crazy. And the way that you presented it was really great. But the stars aligned today with the me listening to Ohio Players in my kitchen. And I love the Ohio Players. As a matter of fact, Sugarfoot Bonner is one of my biggest vocal influences. If you actually listen to some of my music and hear my ad libs when I just kind of start singing random melodies and phrases, I do a lot of like a lot of owls and a lot of woes. Yeah. And he's huge influence on me, so I'm gonna roll with the Ohio Players on this one.
Hey, go from the heart, man. No hate,
straight out of Dayton, representing Dayton.
All right, guys, so I pick up a point. I'm first on the board, but more importantly, I get to select the next category. And I think we're going to go over to the news round. And maybe we'll hear a story about a gentleman who the stars didn't align for. We'll go over to the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, Arizona, January 31st, 1976. A man wanted for allegedly causing a disturbance at a hotel was arrested when he stepped into a police car under the impression that it was a taxi. Police said Prescott police officer Jim Moriarty was sitting in his marked police car down the street from the hotel early on Thursday when a man came running up, jumped into the car, and declared, "Let's get out of here. The pigs are after me." Moriarty, who said he realized the man believed he was in a taxi, replied, "Okay, but you'll have to pay the amount on the meter." The man, Richard Lewis, 24, of Prescott, Arizona, was taken back to the St. Michael Hotel and issued a summons on a charge of disturbing the peace and malicious mischief. Police said he had gotten into an argument with a front desk clerk and when he allegedly threw an adding machine on the floor and broke it. So that's what I got for a news story. This guy gets into an altercation at a hotel, runs down the street, jumps into a marked police car, and tells the police officer to drive him away because the pigs are after him.
Wow.
This is 1976, so that guy throwing an adding machine onto the floor just ruined their business for the entire Shit's done.
I like that. That's a really malicious mischief is a hard thing to say. That's a malicious.
It is.
I heard you have a trouble with that. I was like, damn, that's a tongue. Malicious mischief. It's hard.
We got another one of them MMs down here.
All right, Joe Finley, what did you bring for the news round?
All right. Well, I brought some warmth. I brought some good news that follows decades of bad news.
Nice.
Look, we all know the impact of the Cold War between the U.S. and Russia. I'm not going to talk about all the bad stuff. Let's talk about the awesome stuff. Let's talk about Bond movies. It gave us spy films. It gave us those crazy duck and cover films that we can watch now and go, wow, that is bananas. But it was a genuine fear back in those days because the Cold War was no joke. But on January 26th, assuming after they listened to the inaugural Big Day Out festival in Sydney, Australia, Boris Yeltsin and George W. Bush, or George H.W. Bush, announced that they were no longer going to be targeting each other's countries with their nukes and gave orders to point their nukes elsewhere. So Boris Yeltsin stopped pointing all Russian nukes at the United States, and the U.S. stopped pointing all of theirs at Russia and the remaining communist countries. The following week, only just a day removed from my week, they announced the official end of the Cold War, and this was the beginning. And for the first time, people who lived through the bulk of this, for the first time, could legitimately, you know, have a sigh of relief that those duck and cover videos could be kind of a joke now, because it wasn't something that could potentially happen at any moment. So this was the day, January 26th, Boris Yeltsin, George H.W. Bush, pointing their nukes elsewhere.
Wow.
Did you ever feel like that was just like a, yeah, sure, totally pointing them somewhere else?
He's got, picks up an Atari, like an Atari thing, and he's like, oh, I'm pointing it right.
They never said they didn't point them back, though. We pointed it away for like an hour, dude, and then we just pointed them right back.
They're like, all right, switch it.
just go back. They're gone now.
I feel bad whoever they did point them at. Probably all at Canada. Fuck us, right?
All right, Man Crush, what do you have for the news round?
All right, so let's go January 30th, 1985. And this story is so canon, it's not even debatable. If you don't know the story of canon films, I definitely recommend going out and finding yourself a copy of Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films. This is a great documentary. It's not on Netflix anymore, but I'm sure you can find it streaming somewhere. If you are a fan of any Canon movie, you will love it. If you don't know who Canon Films is, you will be a fan. It's one of those documentaries. You have to see it. And also, this would be a good time to mention this one. Rest in peace, Adolfo Quiñones, a.k.a. Ozone. From the Breaking movies, super nice dude. We had him on the show a few years ago.
What?
Yeah, super funny guy. He actually passed away December 29th of this past year. Damn. So first guest we ever had to pass away. So pretty sad.
I think Turbo might have passed away a while back too. I think they might. Turbo and Ozone were like a team, right? Or on the Breaking movies. Maybe Turbo's still alive. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I hope so. I hope there's not another death in the Breaking franchise.
Yeah. If he's still alive, edit that part out. Actually, keep it in because that was a good laugh.
It was kind of shocking though to see that one when it popped up, because the dude, like on his Instagram, we follow him and stuff, and he looked fine, and then he just passed away. It kind of sucks. But anyhow, this story right here, it's Death Wish 3 to roll on in March. It's almost too spooky to be, believed. What? Who wrote this? Daily News is who wrote this. It's almost too spooky to be believed. I think that's what they meant. But Canon Films is headed for New York this March to film Death Wish 3. Right in the middle of the controversy involving Death Wish gunman Bernard Goetz. The film will again star Charles Bronson as the movie's vigilante, and location shots will start grinding away March 18th at various locations around the city. Some of the movie will also be shot in London. And I quote, "We will be shooting all over town," a spokesman for Canon Film said yesterday. And another quote, they said, "Yes, I imagine there will be scenes of Bronson traveling in the subways." And if you've ever seen Death Wish 3, it's a fucking, talking about roller coasters. This one is... it's crazy. But now, if you're unaware who Bernard Goetz was, he was the New York City subway vigilante. On December 22nd, 1984, Goetz was being harassed by four Bronx teenagers who approached him on the subway. They demanded that they give him $5. Goetz pulled out a gun and shot them. He paralyzed one of the guys. So this was like huge nationwide news, and he was being touted as the quote-unquote Death Wish gunman. That's what they were calling him before he turned himself in. That in itself, it's a pretty wild story. Just a bridge version. He ended up getting off with a firearms charge. And I think he actually ended up running for mayor in like the early 2000s, if I'm not mistaken on that one. But it's funny how Canon Films, you could just picture Menachem Golan. If you've seen the documentary, if you know anything about Menachem Golan, one of the owners of Canon, that jumped all over this shit. and went right in to film Death Wish 3 to benefit from like all the controversy that was going on. Totally canon films. But Death Wish 3 comes to New York again. That's what I got.
So wait, what incident was the one that occurred on the date? Was it the thing on the subway, or was it the release of the movie?
It's just them talking about they're going to do Death Wish 3 in New York City.
The thing that happened on the date was the article.
It was the article. Yeah.
Got you. Okay.
This was the announcement of Death Wish 3. Basically, the only reason they did this was because of Bernie Goetz. If the Bernie Goetz thing never happened, Death Wish 3 would have taken place in like San Francisco again, or like Chicago or something. But nope, New York City, because hey, go where the news is, and that's totally canon films. He knew that he can turn a quick buck on that one, and he did.
All right, let's throw it down to our guest judge, Wax, for the ruling on the news round.
Okay, well, we got the guy jumping in the cop car thinking it's a taxi. We got the Boris Yeltsin and George Bush Sr. Quote-unquote agreement. And then we got the canon films. I don't know the thing Man Crush was talking about with this Death Wish thing. I got to be honest with you, it didn't pique my interest that much. It wasn't really something that I had prior interest in. The guy jumping into the cab, I mean, into the police car, was a funny story. That was a funny story. And his name was Richard Lewis, which made me think of Richard Lewis, the comedian, yes, doing that.
That's all I could picture in my head.
Yeah, it was like him being all neurotic. Like,
yes.
Yeah. I thought it was a cab. I can't do Richard Lewis. I thought it was a cab. Because he was, and Richard Lewis is an alcoholic. It sounds like something he would have done before he got off the wagon. But you know what? I just find the story that Mr. Finley told to be funny, and probably is going to be my winner, because it is a funny announcement that they are just like, they just like agreed, like, we're not going to nuke each other anymore, because it's so really meaningless. Yeah, it really is. something could happen the next day that makes them go, actually, fuck that.
You told us.
Yeah, turns out it's not that hard to point these things.
You know, when people are like, my word is bond, like their word is so not bond that it's funny to me. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like telling your wife you didn't cheat on her. It's like, yeah, you told her that. It's just silly words, which is what politicians normally do. And also Boris Yeltsin, man. I just thinking about Boris Yeltsin, I hadn't thought about him. I like how we thought that was so great, but now Russia is just this crazy dictatorship anyway. Like, it doesn't. Yeah. We realize now that like these titles of like, oh, they're communists, oh, they're a dictatorship, and it's like, you know, America can kind of be a dictatorship in a way, if we, you know what I mean?
Right.
But yep. all that I say to say that Mr. Finley with the 90s thing gets the point for me on this one.
All right, Joe Finley, you pick up a point and you get to control the board. What category are we going with next?
All right, guys. Well, let's take a little trip to the big screen. Let's do movies. All right. I'm going to take you to the Sundance Film Festival, just coming to an end for 1992, and one of the last three movies to play on the 25th was my pick today, and it's a doozy, and the movie that was playing was Poison Ivy, starring Drew Barrymore, the seductive thriller starring a teenage Drew Barrymore, teenage-ish Drew Barrymore, and Sarah Gilbert, Tom Skerritt, a baby-faced Leonardo DiCaprio in it, and it's about a seductive teen befriending an introverted high school student and scheming her way into the lives of a wealthy family. The film spawned three sequels. Part 2 starred Alyssa Milano, and Part 3 starred Jamie Presley. Part 4 was a straight-to-TV release, and the name of the star of that one doesn't escape me, but didn't really matter, so we skipped that. But this actually was nominated for a grand jury prize. I did not get it. It was also the same week that Reservoir Dogs premiered. Of course, that didn't premiere within my week. Doesn't count. But Poison Ivy, a sexy Drew Barrymore who was of age, and the discovery of teenage boys everywhere. This was right around the right time for me to discover this movie, and then they just kept coming after that.
I see what you did.
All right, Man Crush, what do you have for the movies round?
All right, so let's go February 1st, 1985. And like what I was talking about before with great parody in the 80s, they did it again. So if something was successful, especially in movies, like a smaller studio would just jump right in and make their own version of the same movie. And like some were total piles of shit, some had like a great cult following, and some were just a massive joke. And I don't know where this one fits in. It's one of those. I'll leave that to you guys to decide. So in 1983, we get the hit Flashdance, right? So you had Jennifer Beals. She's like a welder or some shit, and she works as a stripper on the side, something like that, and she wants to go to ballet school. So just another story about like the American dream. So in 1984, director Lawrence Dane, he took notice to this, and he said to the world, hold my beer. So on February 1st, 1985, we got the movie that everyone was clamoring for. Everybody wanted this. A story of a young single mom working for the man. And then she quits her job as a secretary and opens up her own jazzercise gym called Heavenly Bodies. Everybody was clamoring for this. Everybody wanted this. And I know that itself, it's totally riveting story. And that would probably garner like lots of praise on its merit alone. But Lawrence Dane, he didn't stop there. We get some really awkward, sweaty sex scenes. We get a battle between two jazzercise dynamos for one spot on a daily like workout TV show. Pretty cool. Scandalous business practices and an amazing ending. Like Heavenly Bodies, this raked in $2 million at the box office. That's $5 million in 2021. And if you think of this movie, it's like a perfect cross between Flashdance and Sylvester Stallone's Over the Top. But in lieu of arm wrestling, like the tournament, to finish this movie, we are gifted with a jazzercise battle of the century. And it's live on television, and it's billed to be bigger than the Super Bowl. And the rules are simple. There's two gyms that compete on live TV until one person is left standing doing jazzercise. Our leading lady, I mean, she's clearly like the jazzercise equivalent of Lincoln Hawk from Over the Top. She's attacked the night before. And during that attack, she suffers a scratch on her thigh. Literally, that's what it looks like. It's a scratch on her thigh. And that gives her problems throughout the pinnacle of the cinematic masterpiece, which is the ending. And I'm not going to spoil the ending. This deserves to be seen. Go and find it. And if it's any consolation, Playboy actually co-produced this gem. So go out and watch yourself some Heavenly Bodies about jazzercise.
Oh, fantastic. Wow. Great pick, Man Crush. Absolutely the best movie based on aerobics ever. Hands down.
What about Perfect?
What makes it even better is there's about 7 minutes of dialogue in this entire movie. And in an hour and a half, it's all action. All nothing but jazzercise action. So
it's made for the modern man.
It's I've never seen this movie. It's produced by Playboy, and you said there's a lot of sex in it.
There are two sex scenes, and they're both very awkward. You have the leading actress. She gets nude. She's actually in a scene where she's giving a jazzercise class, and this dude, before he hooks up with her for real, I don't even know if it's like, I watched this last night. I don't even know if it's really happening or if he's just fantasizing that he's having sex with her, because she's in front of the class and they keep cutting out to the scene where they're fucking. And it's really weird. It's like black and white and they're both real sweaty and it's like in slow-mo. Like there's no penetration that you could see really happening in the position that they're in. It's very weird, but she has a great body. Great body. But yeah, it's about jazzercise, man. You can't go wrong with the movie. It's probably the best jazzercise movie ever made.
Yep,
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that right now.
Major point deduction, though, for no penetration.
Right.
Come on, it's not porn. serious cinema, dude. Jazzercise.
I think the lack of penetration takes away from what you said about it being the best movie about jazzercise ever. There's a few jazzercise with penetration movies that I say give it a run for its money.
See, with Poison Ivy, so many people were inside each other. It was like Russian dolls.
Oh, jeez.
There is a fight scene, too. During the, I will throw this one out there, slight spoiler. There's a fight scene between two guys during the final jazzercise battle that's live on TV.
Oh, my God.
You can't top this. It's like, I'm telling you, just go and see Heavenly Bodies.
All right, gentlemen, for my movie selection, we're going to go over to an article written in the Daily World, January 25th, 1976. Entertainer of the Year Award winner Ben Vereen stars in a dramatization of an incident in the life of Louis Armstrong when the famed jazz man's life was threatened by Chicago gangsters in Louis Armstrong, Chicago Style, the ABC Sunday night movie, airing January 25th at 8:30 to 10 o'clock p.m. In 1931, young Armstrong, played by Ben Vereen, is playing in a sleazy nightclub on the outskirts of Los Angeles, where packed audiences come to hear the young black man from New Orleans play his unique style of trumpet. This small-time success, however, is not enough for his manager, played by Red Buttons, who wants to book him into a Chicago nightclub when Armstrong insists on staying where he is. The manager secretly frames him on a marijuana charge, and Armstrong is forced to leave town. In Chicago, Louis plays at a friend's small night spot, but when word of his popularity gets around, the owner of the mob-orientated club makes him an offer he has to refuse. That refusal leads to the beating of his friend and a threat on Louis's life. The movie has a 6.1 rating on IMDb with just over 40 votes. It's a deep cut of some deep dish. Louis Armstrong, Chicago Style, the ABC Sunday night movie, January 25th, 1976.
Dude, that doesn't make me feel so bad anymore because Heavenly Bodies has 707 reviews on IMDb. It has 5.3. It's pretty solid for jazzercise.
Well, gentlemen. Well, we got well versus well. Anyway, that was a great delivery. That was delivered really well. The voice that you used, and I will say it's interesting that we got a jazz movie and a jazzercise movie, which makes me. I've actually always thought this was weird. Like when dance schools, when they're like, yeah, we do jazz dancing. They've never actually danced to like jazz. You know, like they don't dance to like. What I know, it's not like they play Miles Davis and start doing dance. You know what I mean? It's more like maybe they do some level of like big band swing and stuff like that, I guess. But, you know, you got a jazzercise with some fighting. You got a jazz with some gangsters. And then you got Poison Ivy. Obviously, the celebrity points are going to go to Poison Ivy. Louis Armstrong. Who doesn't love Louis Armstrong? You know, and back in 1976, they did a made-for-TV movie between 8:30 and 10. I mean, that's a short movie with commercial breaks, an hour and a half plus commercial breaks. Yeah. We're talking about a 50-minute movie. It's not even a movie. It's like an episode of
it's like
show,
a sitcom.
You know what I mean?
It's like a special Blossom.
You know, I think though, out of all that, I think in this case, I got to give it to Heavenly Bodies. I think Heavenly Bodies is going to take this category. Because Man Crush was selling it so hard, I just felt sympathy for him. he was going so hard with the sales pitch. I was like, you know, if you're a nice person and you go to buy a car and somebody's like you got all these used car salesman types, and then you got the one guy that clearly like doesn't really sell a lot of cars. Doesn't not really supposed to be a used. Come on, man. It's good. It's good cars. Civics are good. You know. So I felt a little sympathy with that sales pitch. That said, you intrigued me enough that I really do want to watch the movie.
It's not terrible. Like part of my selling, if I have to put an hour and a half of my life into watching it, I'm going to do my damnedest to make sure that it sounds sort of okay. And like there are parts of it, and I read some reviews where people are saying that it's better than Flashdance, It's been a long time since I saw Flashdance, but I don't know if I'd put it in that echelon, but it is a fun watch if you take it for what it is. It's fucking jazzercise.
Right. Well, it made it fun. And we were just talking about breakdancing. So this is a different, I mean, it is still a battle dance movie. And you said there was some sex in it, which, you know, was cool. The fact that it was made by Playboy, and it's kind of, I would like, if you pitched Flashdance and then you pitched that, I would definitely rather watch that. What put it over the top is the Heavenly Bodies pun, because it's a pun that like makes you think of like planets, and there's nothing to do with planets. No, you know what I'm saying? It makes you think of like, it's an astronomy pun. There's no astronomy involved. You know what I mean? So I like that.
The weird part going into this movie is I thought it was going to be like a women empowerment movie. And then maybe like 15 minutes into it, after she opens the gym, she has these football players that are in there that kind of like challenge her, and she beats them all in these exercises. And then this chick just like gets topless and starts dancing around them in the gym, like just teasing them. And I was like, all right, so it's not a women's empowerment movie. That's out. This is totally different. All right, roger that.
There's no movies from the 80s that were, if you look at them now, were women empowerment movies. Like,
no, it.
There's some 80s. I mean, you guys know, like, you watch some of these 80s movies, you can't believe that the way women were looked at back then, you know?
Well, if you're interested, it's on Vimeo. It's on Vimeo. You can go and find it. That was the only place I was able to find this movie.
That's funny. I was thinking about how I was going to find this movie. Now the fact that I'm going to watch it, you win.
I'll find it and I'll send you the link and you let me know what you thought.
Perfect.
All right, Man Crush, you tie up this game, and we got two categories left. We got hot products and we have television. What category are we going with next?
All right, let's go television first. Let's go January 29th, 1985. And not too often do I get to select a specific television episode. I think the last time I remember doing this was when Boy George was on an episode of the A-Team.
Yeah.
And that was a long time ago. That was like 3 years ago. But midway through the first season of this hit series, this happens to be a pivotal episode. This is a sitcom. It's season one, episode 14. The title of this one is Guess Who's Coming Forever. A little background on the show. This is an ABC gem. It lasted 8 seasons, 196 episodes. It was typically found around the top 10 of the ratings, maybe a little bit outside. So we're talking about a pretty solid show. Honestly, I would have figured that the ratings would have been a little bit better than they were for as popular of a show as this was. But you have to think about the competition in the 80s, and it was pretty stiff. And as much as our listeners hate spinoffs and reboots, this one has legs. Back in August, Sony announced that this show was coming back to the old boob tube, so be on the lookout for that one. But before we get too far, let me just ask everybody here. I'm sure you've all seen the show, okay? So on the show, who's the boss? Who is the boss? Let's just go one by one here. Joe, who's the boss and who's the boss?
Hey, there's an episode of Community that covers this greatly, and the answer is Angela Bauer.
Okay. All right, Mark?
Mona, clearly.
Okay. And what about you, Wax? What do you
think? Angela Bauer all day.
Angela Bauer. See, I have to agree with Mark. I got to go with Mona here. Yeah. I mean, she told Tony what to do.
Yep.
She banged Tony's cousin. Angela let her live in her house and paid for her to live in the barn that she renovated for after she threatened to move to New London, Connecticut.
Right.
She basically manipulated Angela to do whatever she wanted. She didn't. Well, did she? I think she did have sex with some of Angela's exes.
She might have.
If I remember correctly, I think she did.
That's dark.
I mean, that's boss shit right there. And shit, I remember when Tony was a science teacher. This is like towards the end of the series.
Yeah.
And he had to leave for something she did. I think she like fucked with the plumber or something. And he had to go deal with the plumber. So he had Mona like just watch his science class in middle school. And she gave a bunch of middle schoolers a sex ed class while he was gone. I mean, that's boss shit right there. That's it in a nutshell. Anyhow, like none of this would have ever happened. She would have never become the boss or even a staple on this show if it wasn't for this episode. This is the episode where Mona gets evicted from her apartment for owning a dog, and she moves into the renovated barn for the remainder of the show. And I mean, this episode, she flirts with the contractor and his son at the same time in the kitchen, which is, I mean, and then he invites her upstairs. It's like typical Mona. I mean, I might have called her Monica a couple times, but she's fucking Mona. So I think, like, she's the boss, man. This is where it started. This is when she moves in. January 29th, 1985. It's when the real boss moves in. Guess who's coming forever? And knowing that this is Mona, do you think this is like a double entendre here?
Of course it is.
On that name?
Definitely.
It has to be.
It's got to be. If it's not, I'm really disappointed. Mona was the ultimate puppet master. She was pulling the strings of everybody because she told Angela what to do. She told Tony what to do. And, well, fuck those kids.
Yeah, well, they listened to her. They like looked up to her because she would ask Angela something and then Angela would say no. And they would go to Mona and Mona would be like, okay.
Because they know who had the real power in the house.
Yeah.
But Eddie, the water guy, not having that shit.
I don't know if they meant that as a double entendre. They must have. You're right. They must have. Why would they call it that? Who's coming?
It says, guess who's coming, comma, forever.
Joe, after watching Poison Ivy.
Because if it wasn't supposed to be a double entendre, it would be staying or something. You know, because you're staying forever. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. They slipped one past us.
Coming forever. Sounds like even after she dies.
She did pass away a couple years ago.
She did.
I need to go watch that. I she was like, you know, to my young eyes, she was like an old lady. But I bet now, I bet now she doesn't. And now she'd be like, you know, somebody you meet on Tinder or something. You know what I mean?
Like, you look a lot younger in your photo.
All right, Joe Finley, what did you bring for the television round?
All right. Well, when I was with you guys a couple of weeks ago, I talked about a Super Bowl. This is not that, but you're going to hear some Super Bowl related things. Just go on a journey with me for a minute. January 26th, 1992 was indeed a Super Bowl Sunday. And that year they did a show called, for their halftime show, they did a show themed Winter Magic, a salute to winter. And it was also a veiled promo for the upcoming Winter Olympics. Brian Boitano and, Dorothy Hamill did some skating around. They had big dancing inflatable snowmen. The University of Minnesota marching band was there. It was a whole thing, but it was very indicative of the half times that people experience. I mean, younger listeners probably don't really even understand this because they're more used to the more recent type of halftime show. But anything from here all the way back to the beginning was just marching bands, blah, 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 and just kind of an opportunity to, you know, give everybody a break. Give the TV folks a break. Give everybody a break. Get a couple more commercial breaks in, too. But Fox, the young bad boys, said, not this year. We are going to offer, for the first time really ever, some counter-programming for the halftime show, and we are going to steal some of the viewers. Jamie Kellner from Fox actually said, we should do a live episode of In Living Color. We'll make a big deal out of it, and we'll convince America to turn the channel at halftime. And that is what they did on January 26, 1992, at halftime. Fox cut out of their broadcasting and went to a live episode of In Living Color with all your favorites, Keenan Ivory Wayans, Damon Wayans, Jim Carrey, everybody was there. This was in season two of In Living Color. It was such a big deal when the halftime show, when the NFL got word of it, they quickly and hastily added Gloria Estefan to the end, because what says Winter Magic like Miami Sound Machine? And but they did a complete commercial-free episode. It was sponsored by Frito-Lay. They provided $2 million for the episode to go to air. And it featured some of the mainstay sketches of In Living Color. It had the Homeboy Shopping Network, Fire Marshal Bill, the usual men on film, but they did men on football. Everything was skewed towards football. The Homeboy Shopping Network, they were actually in the locker room of the Super Bowl stealing things from the players as they were playing. And then Fire Marshal Bill was in a sports bar, and Men on Football, obviously talking about football. They ad-libbed because they weren't being censored, or it was live, so I mean, they can sneak stuff in, but they ad-libbed a Richard Gere gerbil joke.
Always classic.
the best part, though, is basically they had a setup where the president of the network was there, and if he felt something went too far, he was going to tap the guy on the shoulder, and he was going to mute the audio on the 10-second delay. They didn't have a standards and practice guy there. They actually had the president of the network. But the joke made him laugh so hard, he forgot to tell him to do it. So it made it to air.
Amazing.
But now the question is, did they steal viewers? You're damn right they did. It had 29 million viewers. 9.8 million viewers left the Super Bowl halftime show. That's not a drop-off they ever had, because even if you didn't watch the halftime show, you left the channel on until the game came back.
Right.
So they never had drop-offs before, and they had a drastic drop-off this time. And that's a big deal in and of itself, but what really is the big deal is what happened after that, because that was the end of that kind of Super Bowl halftime show. The following year, they hired Michael Jackson. And they did the whole heal the world thing. And since then, you've gotten Prince, Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen, Janet Jackson. It's that was the impetus of the birth of the halftime show as we know it, because they didn't want somebody else coming at them with counter programming again. So January 26, 1992, in living color, changes the halftime show forever.
Wow.
All right, guys, for my television selection, we're going to go over to January 27th, 1976, for the debut of this legendary TV show that debuted in the 8:30 time slot as the second half to what is now being billed as the happiest hour on television. A few weeks back, I had the show The Tortellis as my pick in the television round. And now, as far as spinoffs go, that's probably the bottom of the barrel. It was The Tortellis. But my selection this week also happens to be a spinoff. But this one became just as popular as the original show it spun off from. And by its third season, it has become the most watched American television program. I give you the debut of Laverne and Shirley with the episode The Society Party. All right. Now, I think we all know Laverne and Shirley, but it focuses around Laverne DeFazio, played by the great Penny Marshall, of course, and Shirley Feeney, played by Cindy Williams, who actually almost backed out of the show. Another actress was cast and footage was shot before she decided to return to the project. The two lovely ladies were first introduced as bubbly bimbos brought in by Richie and Fonzie in a previous episode of Happy Days. Now, Gary Marshall, the writer, director, and brother of Penny Marshall, saw something special in the two characters, and he kind of developed the show all around them in the same timeline as Happy Days, set in 1958 Milwaukee. So this was the first of one of the only two times where Gary Marshall directed the pilot episode of one of his very own shows. So I'm going to give you the debut of Laverne and Shirley with The Society Party, January 27th, 1976. Fantastic episode. Laverne and Shirley get invited to a really rich and snobby party from an associate at work who really just wants to show his rich grandmother that he smooches with the quote-unquote regular folk. So Laverne and Shirley go to this dress-up formal party, and of course they invite the Fonz, who shows up, and the two girls, Laverne and Shirley, rent, quote-unquote rent, a couple of dresses from Lenny and Squiggy, who actually just stole them from somebody who was at the party. So a guest at the party recognizes the two stolen dresses because they were their daughter's dresses. Hilarity ensues, and of course, the Fonz saves the day in the end. So that's what I give you, the debut of Laverne and Shirley. Hey, sit on it.
You didn't mention Lenny or Squiggy at all?
I did. They rented the dresses from Lenny and Squiggy. Lenny and Squiggy claimed that they got the dresses from his uncle who runs a wax museum. What really happened is they broke into these rich people's houses and stole the dresses.
Sorry, I was distracted. I got a message saying that my Dodge coin went up to 6 cents.
Nice.
So I had to jump on that real quick, so I must have missed that.
All right, let's throw it down to Wax for the ruling on the television round.
All right, well, let me start by saying it's I feel like there's a little bit of a disadvantage to having the 70s because, you know, I wasn't around in the 70s. So while I do have an affinity for a lot of things from the 70s, such as the Ohio Players, for example, as I said earlier, I wasn't actually there. You know, this is all me looking back, you know. So I remember Laverne and Shirley, of course, but I don't, it wasn't, I didn't really affects me, like who, like say Who's the Boss did. I really remember Who's the Boss. I could sing you the whole theme song. I can picture all the characters, you know. And then what was the other one?
It was the Fox Halftime.
Oh, right. Now this one, as soon as you started talking, I remember that Winter Magic thing, because they always cut to, like, when they talk about how halftime shows used to be, they always cut to that when they go like Winter Magic and show the marching bands, you know, as compared to having Prince, or that one year when it was like Britney Spears and Nelly and Aerosmith, and you know what I mean. So yeah, I remember that the Super Bowl was halftime show was different then, but I had never, and I also remember the Living Color thing, and I specifically remember the Richard Gere joke, so, which also made me think, damn, like that was 92. So for 29 years now, at least Richard Gere, pretty much anytime his name is mentioned, has to do with. I mean, 80% of the times I hear somebody mention Richard Gere, it has to do with the gerbil in his anus. Yeah. You know what I mean? So
little known fact, prior guest judge of the show, Lydia Cordell from Too Close for Comfort, thinks that she started that rumor at a hair salon back in, like, this is what she told us. I think she was making fun of it, but this has come out multiple times on the show for some reason. Yeah. Every time Richard Gere comes up, you're absolutely right. Now, all people think about is like tubes of toilet paper and gerbils.
I was thought, like, you know, like gerbil, like G-E-R, and like the gerbil, you know what I mean? Maybe something like, why isn't it a hamster, you know? But
that would be rough. Well, a gerbil would probably be rough too.
But so that made me think of a lot of things. First of all, it made me feel bad for Richard Gere. Like, these things just stick with you, and everywhere you go, somebody, like, how many times has he heard somebody make that joke? It's just like, it'll never go away until he dies. That's, and maybe he probably made peace with it long ago. You know what I'm saying? But that also made me think of how that's another thing. The men on film or the men on football is something that, like, when you watch it now, you're like, holy shit, they could never do this now. You know,
even when Richard Gere dies, it's not going to end. They're gonna carve a hole in the back of his headstone that people are just going to continually shuff gerbils.
Right. If you dig up his tombstone, there's going to be little holes that were gnawed through by the gerbils. We're like, now he's not even going to resist.
But, he's the gerbil king.
The Richard Gere thing, the changing of the guard as far as the Super Bowl halftime show, the classicness of In Living Color. I loved that show so much. The birth of Jim Carrey, the story about the censorship, plus the fact that you could never do men on film again. But above all that, the part of the story that I'd never thought about before, or nobody's ever told me before, was the fact that it was really In Living Color that made the Super Bowl change the way that they operated as far as the halftime show. That tidbit right there is going to put Mr. Finley over the edge once again, and he's going to make the judge, me, give him a point.
All right, Joe, you jump out to a 3-1 lead. Let's see if you can hold on to that lead heading into the hot products round.
All right, so let's talk about some hot products. This product appeared in every newspaper. I only got 2 days in because it kept showing up in different newspapers, and I'm like, okay, this seems good enough for me. I don't bring up cars a lot as a hot product, just because, you know, but this time was an interesting one because it's one of the first times, at least in a long time, that a concept car became a real car. And did so in a very short period of time. So this car was actually released in 1989 as a concept car, and people were clamoring for it. They were like, I want this car. They made a prototype, and it became a pace car in 1991. And it was not street legal, and it was one of a kind. The following year, they released them as a road legal vehicle, and in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, they said on January 25th, the Dodge Viper isn't a dream anymore. This two-seater with an 8-liter V10 engine was originally a concept car, as I said. It was finally released into a road legal car that goes 0 to 60 in 5 seconds and 0 to 100 and stopped in less than 15. Cars were purchased by all sorts of celebrities, David Letterman, Jay Leno, the usual suspects, before the first car even rolled off the line. The dealerships began scheduling demonstration drives in certain cities where it wasn't going to be available yet. Other cities, it was available as of the release of this article, and they were allowing pre-orders where they were doing these demonstration drives. But Tom Keen from Keen on Wheels, the article that I was reading, had a very interesting quote about it. And he said, "The Viper isn't for everyone, yet everyone should take a ride in it. You owe it to yourself to at least find out what a genuine muscle car is all about." The car sold for roughly $55,000, and it sold out fast. Wherever they got, not a lot of them came out initially, and they disappeared from every dealership that they showed up in. So Dodge Viper from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, January
25th,
1992. Nice. All right, Man Crush, what did you bring for the hot products round?
All right, so let's go February 1st, 1985, but let's go back a little bit. So in May of 1984, you had Peter Laird and Kevin Eastman, the owners of a little comic book publishing company called Mirage Studios, and they decided to release a small run of a comic they'd been working on for the past year. And the duo, they named their company Mirage since there was no actual studio, and they were developing the creations from Laird's living room. So neither guy, they had like no money. So they used Eastman's $500 tax return. They borrowed $1,300 from Eastman's uncle, and Laird chipped in the last $200 to his name to print 3,000 copies of their first issue. And whatever money they had left over, they spent on an ad in a magazine that I used to get all the time as a kid. This is how much of a nerd I was as a little kid. But it was a Comic Buyer's Guide monthly. And at that point, they sat and they waited, and they just wanted to see what would happen. And both guys were basically dead broke at this time, so they had nothing to lose. And it turned out the ad worked. So within a few weeks, Mirage sold all 3,000 copies of their issue. With orders now, they were like just pouring in from distributors all over the country. The fellows, they re-released a second print of 6,000 copies in June. So now Laird and Eastman, they felt like they were onto something here. Initially, the whole thought behind this was this particular comic was just going to be a one-off. It was going to be one issue. Let's see what happens. But the demand was so high, they decided to release issue number 2 in January of 85. So right out of the gate, they sold 15,000 copies of issue number 2 without batting an eyelash. I mean, this was simple. However, the distributors, they demanded that they also produced 30,000 reprints of issue number 1, because nobody got their hands on. There was only, 9,000 of them out there, and people were talking about this thing. So the third print of that comic was released on February 1st, 1985. And even though they printed 30,000 copies, the distributors had orders for 50,000 copies, so they couldn't even keep up. So this little comic book, they called it Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I mean, there's no need for me to sell this one up here. However, to date, there are 6 reprints of the first issue from May of 1984. Reprint number 3, which we have here, was the last one to basically carry the same cover as the original. The only exception, there's slightly more blood on the second tee in Turtles. The only difference of the whole thing. But the third print, it's obviously the easiest of the top three to find. It still goes for a couple $100, between $500 and $600. But the original, if you have it, there's one that sold for $40,000.
Wow.
It's freaking crazy. I mean, we all know what it built up. It's like a $1 billion industry. This is where it started right there. I mean, they ramped it up from that May of 1984, 3,000, couldn't keep up, printed another 6,000, and they did another 30,000. February 1st, 1985, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles by the Little Mirage Studios.
Wow. Cowabunga.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So for my hot product, I went over to newspapers.com and I looked up the top selling records for that week. Now, the best selling record for most of January, including the last week of the month, which was my week, is, according to Rolling Stone magazine, one of the 100 greatest country songs of all time. The song also spent 6 weeks in the number one spot on the country charts and 1 week at the number one spot on the pop charts. This song was so popular, it inspired a 1978 movie by the same name and also had a couple of sequels. Not the movies, but the song. My pick for hot products is a record that everybody apparently had to own in January of 1976, despite the main vocals not being more than just spoken word. I give you Convoy by C.W. McCall. The song's main story is told through a CB conversation that is riddled with trucker slang. It's about a fictional trucker rebellion that drives from the West Coast to the East Coast of the United States without stopping, protesting worker conditions for truckers. By the end of the song, they've crashed through several roadblocks set up by the police. As the convoy has grown to almost 100 trucks, including 11 long-haired Friends of Jesus in a chartreuse microbus, and a trucker named Sodduster, who is referred to as a suicide jockey because he is driving a truck hauling explosives. I give you Convoy by C.W. McCall. It was the top-selling record the last week of January, 1976.
Wow.
Is that something I'm supposed to know, like, that just flew over my head, or is that just, like, a really deep cut?
You've never heard Convoy, man?
No, no. All right, so that's what I mean. Like, I don't know.
I hate to admit it, but I wish you could play it. I feel like it's one of those things where if we heard it, we'd be like, oh, that.
Yeah. We got a great big convoy. my favorite thing actually ever with that was the first time that entered my consciousness was in The Simpsons, where he had some like loudspeaker thing or whatever, and he was singing Convoy at everybody.
Yeah, the song became a huge phenomenon. It inspired a movie. Ooh. The song had a couple of sequels. Hey, if you're a big fan of truckers and CB talk, you can't go wrong with Convoy, man.
I am.
You don't know what you're missing out on then. I mean, this brought the popularity of the CB into the mainstream. Like, after this song came out, everybody wanted a CB. They were buying them for their homes. I mean, that's like the equivalent of Drake when he came out with that song about calling you on the cell phone or whatever. Everybody in America going, oh my God, I gotta get a cell phone now.
Yep. Dude, that was like 2 years ago. Everybody had a cell phone.
Nobody had a cell. They didn't know they were phones.
But in 1976, people heard a song about somebody talking on a CB and wanted, everyone had to own a CB at that point.
I got a CB in my RV. Nobody's ever on it.
All right, let's toss it down to Wax for the final ruling on the Hot Products round.
I really liked the bit about this, the Drake bit about everybody rushing out to get a cell phone because they heard Drake say it. Love that. That's a good bit. But the thing is that, you know, and maybe this has to do with what I said before. Unfortunately, I wasn't around in the 70s, and this Convoy thing sounds like one of those things where it's like it was a huge, huge hit. And to a certain amount of people, it's also a timeless hit. But to me, it's not a timeless hit because I'm unfamiliar with it, which I'm ashamed to say, you know, as a guy that likes to be up on musical.
It's one of
like
those
that.
Songs you're gonna go look it up later and you're gonna be like, oh, it's that fucking song.
Right. I love that you said the song has sequels. That's something that like country artists do. Like if something made money, like they'll do that shit into the ground. They're like movie studios in that way, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So we got the Convoy and we got the Dodge Viper. I remember the Dodge Viper being this huge deal. I did not know that when it first was used as a pace car that it was not actually street legal. That I didn't know. And then we got the, you know, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is really a landmark in creativity. It's really something that I think about a lot. I think about the concept of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, a real triumph in stoner creativity. You know what I mean? Like, it's so off the wall. Like, not only are they turtles, not only are they mutants, not only are they teenage, but they're also ninjas. On top of that, their names are old painters, and they all like pizza and talk like surfer dudes. Like, the amount of variables that these guys have, it's just, you know, most superheroes or cartoon characters be like, oh, he can fly. Like, they got one variable. You know what I mean? They have so many things, and they have... It just makes you think, like, it's possible to think of something really zany and really off the wall and have it be really hugely successful. But the thing that they did, the thing that this company that Man Crush was talking about did, was what a lot of people don't. Like when before we started recording today, we all had an idea for a movie. We came up with an idea for a movie that was a good idea for a movie. And are we gonna do what those guys did? What's the name of the company, the original comic book company?
Mirage.
Are we going to do what Mirage did? Absolutely not.
Speak for yourself. I've been writing notes this whole time.
Yeah. I got a Kickstarter rolling.
Yeah, we would need a Kickstarter. We would need a Kickstarter for our movie about, you know what? I'm not even going to give it away.
Yeah, you can't talk about it. You can't talk about it.
Yeah, not going to give it away.
Non-disclosure agreements all around.
As a matter of fact, what movie? We never said anything about any movie. But the fact that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and that was a good story about how they rose from, you know, having the 3,000 print to then the 10. Whatever those numbers were, so we know what it is now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I got to go over Convoy and over the Dodge Viper. It struck a personal chord with me as a creative dude. You know, the Dodge Viper, great. It's a car and it goes fast. I mean, you know, I don't know. You build a better engine? It's not like you did something that nobody ever thought of. Like, you know what? Let's make a car that goes even faster than other cars. You know? I mean, these dudes are they're turtles, they're ninjas, they're mutants, they're named after painters. They all have a different weapon. They live in the sewer. Their boss is a rat. They're everything about it is super hyper creative. So as a creative individual myself, I have to give this to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Mirage Comics and Man Crush.
And they actually started out with Japanese names too, but then they were like, nah, it's not going to work. So that's where they came up with the painters' names.
Right.
So imagine that.
Most people my age would not know those painters' names if it wasn't for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That's true. That's
sad.
And then I'd know Leonardo da Vinci. I wouldn't know Raphael. Who the fuck is name a work by Raphael? Do it.
I don't know. Is he a shortstop for the Indians?
That's funny. Yeah. The only thing you can say about the painter or sculptor, I don't even know what kind of art he did. He's a freaking Ninja Turtle.
All right, Man Crush, you know what that means. This game is all tied up between you and Joe Finley, so we're going to roll on to a final wild card round.
All right, so I'm going to do this one quick because I did not expect to even tie once again. So let's go to another comic book, February 1st, 1985. It was the release of Amazing Spider-Man number 261. And that was Sins of My Father. And this is the one where Mary Jane Watson and Liz Osborne, they've been captured by the Hobgoblin. And he's basically threatening to kill them until Harry Osborne turns over the remaining journals of his father. I didn't read this whole series, but I think they were already destroyed by Spider-Man in the past. So he really didn't have anything to give back to them at this point. But it's actually a pretty good comic. But I'm not going to go in depth into it, but it's because we're late anyway. But Amazing Spider-Man, how could you go wrong in 1985? 60 cents? You know motherfuckers were going out to buy this shit. The cover's cool as shit, too. It's got Hobgoblins on the cover, and he's holding Spider-Man down. He's got flames and shit in the background. Really dope-ass cover. Nice. So that's what actually nabbed me on this one was the cover.
Okay.
All right, Joe Finley, what did you bring for the wild card round?
All right, guys, on January 31st, 1992, and if you look back, this is the only day that went past the 26th in my week. I'll give you just the beginning of the trailer. First, he got satisfaction as Action Jackson. Now he hits like a hurricane. Get ready or get blown away. Carl Weathers is Billy Hurricane Smith in Hurricane Smith, also known as Dead on Arrival. It's about an oil field worker from Texas who journeys to Australia to look for his missing sister, and he encounters some violent drug smuggling gang along the way. This is an Australian film where they employed Carl Weathers fresh off of Action Jackson and kind of his heat, you know, in action films, when he was having done Predator and all these things. And so they tried to take that and they brought it down under in what was known as Ozploitation films. Some of the most well-known ones would be things like Mad Max and the like, but there are tons of the Ozploitation films out there. And this was one of them. It was marketed for the U.S. after the fact, but it was produced for Australia. Carl Weathers, Hurricane Smith. Or Dead on Arrival. I prefer Dead on Arrival.
man, when you said Action Jackson, I was like, just give it to him. But when you came with that, I was like, ah, let's see what happens.
Yeah. Such a tease. All right, let's hear the final verdict on this game from our judge, Wax.
Before that, is would Crocodile Dundee is not considered an exploitation movie, is it? It's just that's just a movie with an Australian guy. Right.
Yeah. That's an American movie.
Right, yeah. Right.
That's an enormous movie. If you ever look up how much money that movie made, it's like close to $300 million.
Yeah.
It was the number two movie that year. That's crazy. Yeah.
Paul Hogan. What is he alive?
He's still alive.
Yeah.
His career died after he did what was that, Flipper 3 or some shit?
Right. Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
Actually, he just had, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, they came out with another Crocodile Dundee. Yeah. I never saw it though.
What number is that? 4 or 5?
I think that was 3.
Or is it like 15?
I think they just waited a real long time between the second and the third one.
Yeah, Crocodile Dundee 3, when it came out, actually, there was a really good story behind it because he tried to steal the writing credit. Somebody else wrote the movie, and then they gave it to him to give a pass, and he didn't do anything, and he just submitted it as his own. And so the guys had to sue, and it became a gigantic thing, but basically he didn't write the movie, but he refused for anybody to have credit for it but him.
Damn. You know, he was married to the hot lady from the original for a long time.
Yeah.
Right. Wow.
Good for him.
You know, thinking about him, like after my little spiel there about the success of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I mean, he was a pretty creative character too. That kind of, you almost feel like they could have done more with him. They could have done more like, forget having, like, it doesn't, like, Crocodile Dundee does not have to have Paul Hogan. That could be an animated thing. You know, that they could have taken that character further. But honestly, Steve Irwin kind of became it. You know, as far as my dumb American brain knows, you know.
Blame it all on Yahoo Serious for killing that whole thing.
Yeah. Or you could blame it on all that fish or whatever, that stingray. You know, for killing that whole thing. Anyway, I think I have a winner in my brain, and I'll tell you what. You know, this is going to be kind of I'm going to give a little bit of kind of like a hipster point here, because the Amazing Spider-Man, you know, it's kind of a basic pick. You know what I mean? Spider-Man, Superman, things like that. Whereas Mr. Finley, he came in on Australia and he left on Australia. He started with the Nirvana and Violent Femmes concert festival, and then he left with this dead on arrival exploitation film. Have you been to Australia, Joe?
I've not. They try not to let me out of the country.
They tried not to let him out of the country, but he couldn't be stopped. Crocodile Dundee 4, Finley gets revenge. Crocodile Finley. Yeah.
Crocodile Dundee, Joe forgets about Australia and fucks off to Disney.
So you know what? I'm going to go ahead because of the little just because of the obscurity of the wild cards. When Spider-Man, no offense on the Spider-Man choice. I'm just telling you how I'm making my decision. I'm just talking it through, you know. And I'm going to have to go with Joe Finley for the winner.
That's Cheers. Right. Nice. Totally cool with that, because when I did not think it was going to come to a tiebreaker. I got to start preparing for tiebreakers, because either I feel like I have it in the bag and I don't do it. This one, I just didn't even feel like I'd be there. So I was like, whatever. There's no point. So I wrote some stuff down. I was like, yeah, this looks good. This cover looks badass. But yeah, it's totally fine. You know what, though? The end of January, and I was going to mention this during our first pick, the beginning of January, when we did the week experience a couple weeks back, that was horrible. This one was slightly better, but not that much better.
Yeah, which is odd, because usually the first week of the month is way better. In this case, it was the last week of the month where you saw all the gold.
Yeah. It was also the beginning of the year, so nothing was going on in that episode. True. That was right. That was tough. That was like a lot of digging. This one, there was some digging, but there were some big ones thrown in there. But like, as far as a wild card, like what the fuck was I going to bring? So it's Amazing Spider-Man, baby.
Hey, it was good. It was a valiant effort.
That shit valiant. Happens. But dude, what's going on with you? Like, you doing snacks with Wax? I saw, and one of the things, when we mentioned this before the show, we were talking about the Lunchables thing. Actually, Lunchables was my hot product the week that you released that. And I was like, holy shit, he just released Lunchables. That's fucking awesome. But yeah, that was, but yeah, actually,
so that was in about 85-ish.
Well, it was, I think you said 89.
I said it on there. Whatever I said was based on whatever Wikipedia says.
Yeah. So it did come out. That was when it went out to everybody. I had it in 88 where it was just test marketed in certain areas. But yeah, it's, that was a staple of my childhood, man. So what are you eating? What are you eating these coming weeks on Snacks with Wax that people can look out for?
Yeah, I do a weekly show called Snacks with Wax, and I feel like the show, it's just me and my brother. I have a twin brother, and he is behind the camera, but also talks and gets in front of the camera a little bit. And the show is just like, we have a snack food every week and we review it. And I feel like that pitch is not as good as the show actually is, because it's like the brand of humor we do. We do a lot of weird analogies and whatnot. And the only episode that we have in the can right now, it kind of sucks. This little back injury is kind of taking me out, but I think I'm on the mend. I think, you know, even the one that I put out yesterday, which was, or today, which was, Sour Patch Kids. Like, if you were to see the footage before edited, like in between takes, I'm like, ah, I'm back, you know. but the only one that we've shot so far that we haven't released yet is Krispy Kreme donuts.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
But you know, for anybody listening, like from here on out, all the stuff we do is going to be based on the suggestions from the comments. You know what I mean? So if anybody wants to do a certain thing, the beauty of the show is, like, I mean, you could do it for the rest of your life just based on what's in 7-Eleven, just in one aisle of 7-Eleven. Like, there's no shortage of snack foods. You know what I mean? So I'm really having fun doing it. I'm going to try to do one episode every week this entire year. And hopefully at the end of that, maybe I really actually wouldn't mind trying to get some kind of, you know, I would love to get a job as some kind of host or something like that. You know what I mean?
You could be on the History Channel, dude.
The History Channel?
Oh, absolutely.
Have you seen, have you, Eating History?
Eating History is brilliant.
I have not seen that, no.
You could be the new version of Eating History.
Eating recent, it could be like Eating Recent History. It'd almost be like your show. So it'd almost be like eight more, you know?
You know what I noticed in your last video, the Lunchables one? It almost looked like you guys went to some like skeevy back alley to eat those Lunchables. So it's like, where are they? It's a scrupulous location.
That's funny, because I just moved, actually. I used to live in Los Angeles. I live in San Diego now, and I rent a room from my friend. Owns a construction company, and luck, I got really lucky when I moved down here. He has like a little office space in there, which he was renting out a room for a good price. So I have my apartment where I'm now, but then I also have a little separate music studio, which is there. So out back, it's like this junkyard, basically, which was weird. It's like, why are you there? Where are you? Why are you eating Lunchables there?
It's like the fight alley from They Live.
Right.
It was like somebody sold you that, like, on the corner. They're like, yo, here you go, here's some Lunchables, man. Go try.
Yeah, let's just duck back here in this junkyard. Lunchables real quick.
He's got all these snack foods and Lunchables like dangling from the inside of an overcoat.
You guys ever get any good stories when you're eating? Because sometimes you eat on location, like where you're in like a fast food joint or whatever. Do they ever stop you and bother you, or like they're like, dude, you need to get out, you can't film in here, like you get stuff like that?
Yeah, my show now, Snacks with Wax, is basically a shorter version of what I used to do, which was Chain Reaction, which was a review show for chain restaurants. And there were certain, God, I can't think off the top of my head, but I know that there was places where we got kicked out of Auntie Anne's Pretzels, which was in the mall. So they weren't letting us film in the mall, so we had to go like sit in some. Then you just have to find a spot somewhere. Which that time was, again, in an alley, you know. but there was, there was an extra security guard being kind of like tough guy with us about filming our little pretzel review show. what happens is because all that stuff was done in Los Angeles, they treat that stuff differently there. You know what I mean? Like filming there, like you got to pay somebody if you want to film somewhere. Like if you're at an Auntie Anne's Pretzels in Cleveland, nobody's bothering you for filming. They don't assume you're doing a real show. They just like, whatever. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's also hard to find an angle where somebody in the shot isn't SAG.
Right.
Somebody's cheesing in the background, just waiting for a royalty check.
Right.
Here I am. Now, I watched an episode you guys did. This is a while back. I think you were at Sizzler. Did you get kicked out of Sizzler?
Sizzler, we got kicked out of. Yes, but
it was hilarious.
But we got kicked out at the end. We shot the whole episode, and we got kicked out at the end. It's if you do a show like that, and you kind of keep your footage on the down low, and you're like wrapped. You're like, all right, we got everything we need. That's when you can like be like, okay, now we can do stuff that will get us kicked out. You know, we're getting stupid B-roll footage of me like running around the salad bar, essentially. You know what I mean? And that's when we got kicked out. But we had already gotten the actual reviews where I'm sitting down eating all the food and whatnot.
You trashed everything.
I mean, it's
Sizzler.
It was Sizzler. Yeah, it was Sizzler. There was a lot of bad stuff on that. I mean, there's so many options. The good thing about Sizzler is there's a lot of options. But also, I'm doing the weekly shows, but I'm also writing a lot of new music. That's my actually primary thing is I do music, you know, and I'm working on a lot of new music, feeling creative and whatnot. But I don't know exactly when it's going to come out. You know what I mean?
I just noticed the YouTube thing that you put out. What's the whole title, Mark, that you have written now? It's like 87 words long, which is hilarious.
Oh yeah. And thanks for promoting that earlier in the show. I did put out an album in December. It's called Song, cause I've been doing music on YouTube since like 2007. And there's a lot of songs on there that's, I never put on Spotify. Now most people just use Spotify or some type of streaming service to listen to music. And some of these old songs were like, people are like, I gotta go to YouTube every time I want to hear the song. So I did it's called Old Songs from YouTube That Weren't on Streaming Services Until Now. That's the name of the album. So it's not really, there's one new song on it. And then the rest of it are like old songs that are on my YouTube channel.
It's pretty amazing. My daughter was listening to a song earlier and she wanted to know, I think she was listening to Toothbrush, but she's 14 and she's listening to Toothbrush and she wanted to know why there's three toothbrushes.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people ask me that question because like the song Toothbrush is about a girl who kind of like moves into your house basically too fast. And the telltale sign is that she leaves her toothbrush there. You're like, wait a second, you leaving your toothbrush here already? You're like moving in already. And in the song it goes, there used to be two brushes. Now there's three toothbrushes, as in like I already had two and now there's three, and people are like, why do you have two toothbrushes? And I guess that's a good question. I can only say because it rhymes better.
I said, well, maybe he had a roommate at the time when she moved in that left theirs. I was like, I don't know, I'll ask him,
which is possible. But some people maybe have two, I don't know. But there used to be one brush, now there's two brush. Like it yeah. It's either way, it's not that great, but it's just supposed to show that a difference of one, you know what I mean?
Maybe it's from a previous girl and he's just collecting toothbrushes from all the ex-girlfriends and leaving them there for some strange reason.
Instead of putting notches on his bedpost, he just keeps the
toothbrushes.
there are people who like clean their shoes with a toothbrush. That's what I'm gonna say for now. I got my toothbrush and I got my toothbrush that I use for cleaning my shoes.
But you don't keep it with the other toothbrush. that would be kind of weird.
Yeah, you don't. Oh, don't use that one. Confused.
All right, I gotta brush my teeth. Which one was it again?
That's for my anus.
Then you end up using the girl's toothbrush for the shoes, and then yeah,
Which is funny because like my daughter's 14, And that song's, it's fairly old. Like, they came out probably, what, like 9 years ago or so?
Yeah, about that.
And she's still listening. When she heard you were coming on, she was like, oh, this is a Toothbrush song. So she put it on. And she's like, I always wondered this. It's like, really? You wondered? I'll ask him if you really want me to.
I wish I could give her a better synopsis, but the real synopsis is that it just rhymed better. I guess at the time, maybe I had two toothbrushes. I don't know.
Sometimes you need one that's firm and one that's soft. Like,
I have more than one toothbrush now, but it's like I have a toothbrush that actually just like lives in my backpack for if I travel somewhere. You know what I mean? But
that doesn't count.
Yeah, you're right.
I'll just make a story up to tell her that sounds good. I'll be like, oh yeah, that's it's an ex-girlfriend's toothbrush that was left there. And it's like a girlfriend thing. You'll get it one day. Hopefully you're not the girl that leaves it there.
You'll get it when you're older is always a go-to, huh?
Yeah. I 14, I can't really use that too much anymore.
I'm old, Dad.
Yeah, I'm getting to the point. Like, she was actually, she's watching Freaks and Geeks right now. And I was like, you know, yes. Sam Levine was on the show. And she's like, who's that? I was like, you're watching him right now. That's him right there. Who?
Wow. I'm like,
whatever. It's fine. Whatever. But dude, thanks again for coming on, bro. It's always fun when you come on here, and I hope your back gets better. And
thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. I'm going to send you this link too for this movie. And
I swear, yeah, send it the same way you sent the link to this Zoom. I swear I will watch it. I'm that lame, and I and I mean that's actually a double entendre right now with my back. I'm lame in that way too, like like the old school lame.
I really appreciate
you guys having me on. This was really fun, just like it was last time.
Dude, anytime you want to come on, man. Open invitation.
Hit me up whenever. I didn't know you had Tawny Kitaen on here. Now I feel all famous. You know what I'm saying?
we had a lot of people this last year. Through COVID, I think because a lot of people had nothing going on.
Yeah,
they were doing shows. So we actually had like quite a few people that I was shocked that we got to do this.
That's awesome, man. Good for you guys.
It's a little bit different too, because it's not like we're doing an interview. So you're not getting the same questions and everything. You're being a judge for a game show. So right. Some people just don't want to do it at all. But the people that we got this past year, I was actually a little shocked at some of the people that we got. So it was pretty cool. So hopefully we can keep that up.
Cool. Well, I'm going to go watch Heavenly Bodies, and I'm going to go to your website and see who you had in the past. I'm really curious about that too.
Yeah, go for it, man. Go to duelingdecades.com and you should be able to scroll through it. I just redid it the other day, so it's a little shitty, but you'll see it all. I just sent you that. Enjoy. Let me know what you think.
Awesome. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, on the Twitter, I'm at Big Wax, BIGWAX. On Instagram, I'm at Big Wax, BIGWAX. And my website is wax.com.com. That's WAXDOTCOM.COM.
All right. Thanks, dude.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Feel better, bro.
Peace. Appreciate it.
All right, duelers. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to end this episode right here. Thanks again to our guest judge, Wax, and congratulations to our winner for this episode, Mr. Joe Finley.
Thank you guys very much. Two in a row. That's a rare one for me. I'm pretty thrilled about that. So, yeah, hopefully we can three-peat this bad boy soon.
And just as Man Crush just said, you can always head over to DuelingDecades.com if you've missed an episode and subscribe to the show on iTunes, on Spotify, everywhere podcasts are available. And while you're on those interwebs, head on over to Facebook.com/DuelingDecades where you can join our private group and share some of your very own retro memories. So until next time, duelers, we're going to bid you a peace, love, light, and a joy. Have a grateful week, everyone.
Podcast New York. Podcast New York. Be heard.